Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for October 21st, and we're heading up into the final stretch of this year. Good grief. Anyway, tonight, first topic out of the chute, PFAS chemicals, the EPA. Finally, the bureaucracy of, they're really going to fight for your rights. These are the Environmental Pollution Agency, who has allowed this horrific situation to happen. And these agencies span governments. They span decades. The same people sitting, you might have an appointee for the head of the EPA, but all of these people are career EPA employees, etc. So, you know, to blame it on one administration or the other, no, this is a decades-old problem. These are the famous forever chemicals, and if you have not heard about them yet, you're going to hear about this. It's going to be in your face. But here's a couple of points about this. They are very low amounts of these can be extremely toxic. For example, most toxins are in parts per billion. You have to have, 200-300 parts per, some of them parts per million. So you need really a lot of this stuff to, those type of things, if it's parts per million, then really you need a lot of it to cause damage. You know, lead is one of the things that you have to get out of your water. It's damaging at any level. If you get one atom of mercury or one atom of lead, and that's why by the way shots for kids are so toxic, is because they have mercury in them. Mercury is tremendously toxic. It's in the periodic table and the same as lead. Those are heavy metals, very damaging to the human body, so you got to get those out of your water primarily. But then there's other chemicals and pollutants that are parts per billion. PFAS chemicals are parts per trillion, if you can even imagine this. And so the EPA has set a level of standards, and I don't even know how they do this, of 70 parts per trillion as some kind of safe level. Well, even that is not a safe level, but it gives them some kind of a target market or a target to remove this stuff from water. And so, of course, the big government push is how to remove it from all the water tables, and of course you cannot. And the reason is, the biggest reason is because it's continually leaching out of the soil into the water table. So if you clean up the water table today, tomorrow it's going to have more PFAS chemicals in it. So what's the solution? You have to filter this stuff out at the point of entry at your house, right before you use the water. It could be in the pipes. It could be in the pipes and the distribution in the municipality. It could be in the groundwater that's coming in your well out in the middle of the country. And the thing is, well, you might say, well, I live in the middle of the country. I'm not near one of these PFAS, like a military base or an Air Force base. But what happens is it is in solution in the water, and it actually evaporates in the rain, just like glyphosate. Evaporates and it goes into the rain, and then it rains every place. So it's everywhere. So you have to get it out of your water. And anyway, I've been selling my MR5 water filter now for a long time, but my current product, MR5 water filtration product, is unlike anything else on the market. And I've been selling this thing now and doing very well with it. But it's the only true broad-spectrum water filter on the market. That's point of entry, removes the PFAS and all these other toxins. Don't be fooled by water softener companies. They might have a PFAS removal resin for one of their water softener tanks, but it's very targeted on one particular chemical. It's not a broad-spectrum filter. And today you have to get arsenic out of your water, PFAS chemicals, lead, pharmaceuticals, etc. And that's why my MR5 water filter is just unmatched. and it will work for 50,000 gallons before you have to replace the filter elements. I will help you and your plumber install it. We have a nice, very nicely illustrated instruction installation manual that the plumber will find. And in typical plumber installations, we've had plumbers put these in under an hour. But typically, it's a few-hour job for them to come and set it up. The other thing is that you can get the information, the installation manual, if you put in an order. We can send you the installation manual in by email, and you can give that to your plumbers. So they know what to bring with them when they come to the job. They're not coming and go, oh, well, I need to go get this. Because there are a few things you need specific to installing the MR5. It's not like installing, say, a water heater. It's a little bit more complicated, but any plumber that's worth his salt can put this in a few hours' time, and then you've got water. The thing is, point of entry, it filters it before the hot water heater. So all of the water in your house is filtered. And why is that important? Because when you are in the shower, and please don't tell me you got one of these little screw-on water shower filters. No, those things don't work. That's got a little handful of charcoal in there. It doesn't work. It's not going to do anything. It might remove a little bit of chlorine. It might clean up the smell of your water a little bit, but that's it. And it only lasts for about 30 gallons, and then the charcoal is used up. So anyway, you need a whole house water filter that's a serious commercial water filter that removes the toxins at the point of entry in your house. So this is here's the situation. Your water comes into the house. If you have an issue with hardness or minerals in your water, then you would have a water softener first. And then comes the MR5. The MR5 is not a water softener. And so don't confuse them. That's something I try and stress on my webpage, etc., is that there are companies that sell water filters that really that are trying to sell them as and calling them whole house water filters. They are not. They don't have any kind of mesh screen or filtration for size of particles. Like the MR5 has a 0.1 micron outside shell, and then the inside of the MR5 is a material that is baked and removes all of the toxins, etc. And a water softener has a resin. It's like a powder. It's like sand. Some people might consider that it looks a little bit like sand or something. But anyway, that is designed to remove certain targeted, usually minerals. And those minerals typically are not toxic. And so, but the thing with the water softener is, this is why I am not in the water softener business. There are hundreds of different resins, each resin for one specific chemical or toxin or mineral or whatever is in your water to remove. So to do what the MR5 does, you would need literally about 200 tanks in your house, each one doing a specific job of removing one thing. And so the MR5 is a broad-spectrum water filter. Okay, I'm going to stop here because you can read more about this on my webpage, but the point of me going off into this topic is that the EPA just a few days ago, came out with an actual standard, and mind you, government agencies like municipal or like state agencies or other, say somebody who's an administrator in a university or something like that, or a hospital, could not do anything. Their hands were somewhat tied because even though they knew, for example, PFAS chemicals were a problem, there was no official standard. Not that it really even means anything. Does that mean if you drink 87 glasses with 70 parts per trillion PFAS chemicals in it, you're going to be fine? No. Those things are cumulative. They build up in your body over time. And so if you're a person that drinks a lot of water, and by the way, speaking of which, a lot of people go, well, I'll just buy bottled water. This is the biggest myth on the planet, that somehow these water bottling companies remove everything that's a toxin and put the water in a bottle and sell it to you. It's just ludicrous. I mean, it's just not even near reality. Coca-Cola has, and a lot of these Nestle, a lot of these companies that bottle water, have a tube that goes out into the middle of a lake, and they put it right in the bottle. There's no filtration, nothing. It just goes from the source into the bottle, and you buy it, and you pay a lot of money for it, and it, good grief. You know, the people have this conception, misconception, that somehow bottled water is safe. And then they put it into a plastic, this thin little plastic bottle where the chemicals leach into the water. Bottled water is not a good idea. Anyway, just a little diversion there. But the reason I'm talking once again is because the EPA finally put a standard on the parts per trillion of PFAS chemicals. So now there's going to be a lot of activity where towns and cities and hospitals and communities and et cetera are going to be able to pass legislation to reduce the amount of PFAS chemicals because there's a standard that's been set. Okay, so anyway, and the point of course talking about this is my MR5 filter. My sinker filters and my gravity replacement filter elements remove this also. But the problem in there is that's just for the cold water in the kitchen. So I'm actually on my webpage moving people away from the sink filters completely and telling them, hey, you know, over a 10-year period, this is actually a fact, over a 10-year period, you're going to spend as much on gravity filters, replacement filters, as you do on a whole house water filter. So why not just spring for the whole house water filter and have it in? Then you got hot and cold water filtration in your house. Okay. Now, another thing coming up, just to give you a heads up here, and soon, and I never did this before, but I'm now doing it as a way of doing some more promotion. I'm spending a lot more time promoting my education package. But I'm going to have some, and this is an experiment. I think it's going to work. And right before Christmas, a lot of people could buy these for Christmas presents. But I'm going to have T-shirts and hoodies, et cetera. And if you go to any of the major podcasts, let's put it that way. If you go to any of the major podcasts, like Dan Bongino or Steve Turley or... Oh, just, you know, any of these people who are big names, I mean, they've got big audiences, etc. They have one of the things they sell is their own branded T-shirts and hoodies and cups and these kind of things that people buy. And it's a source of revenue. And so each one has their own kind of sayings or slogans on their shirt that typify their belief system or what they're talking about on their podcast. And so I'm doing the same thing, and I have now a beautiful logo that I just had created by a professional artist for the J. McCanney Science webpage and all my work, my books, my CDs, DVDs, etc. And so that was something that I really never had before. So I'm getting a little bit more organized here in my old age. And so anyway, that'll be on the shirts. And then maybe with a slogan like "Comets are not dirty snowballs," but anyway, this is if it's not on the webpage yet, it'll be there. And then also a new organized checkout. I'm combining my books and CDs and all of that with the webpage that sells the education package. They used to be separate, and now I'm taking the time to combine those. And then also the T-shirts and hoodies and that kind of thing will be there. So it'll be kind of like if you were wearing one of these, it'd be like walking advertisement in a sense, also showing your support for me. And then other people say, well, J. McCanney Science, and they, you know, they can go to the webpage and learn more about my work, etc. But they're very colorful. They're and also super high quality. These are like Hanes hoodies. Next level T-shirts, which are very high quality. I have some next level T-shirts that I've been wearing for years, and they're like still like new. So very high quality. and then something that is a logo on there. I have some T-shirts left that I got during the X Prize when I was a finalist in the Water Abundance X Prize. I'm still wearing these. I looked at the brand the other day. They're Next Level and very high quality. And I thought, man, that's, you know, I buy T-shirts and they after a couple of years or something, after wearing them and washing them a lot of times, they look a little faded, you know, but not this one. And so anyway, these are very high quality T-shirts, hoodies, and there'll be, I think, cups and various things like that. And of course, I'm not going to fulfill them myself. It's set up through a fulfillment house. And so it's completely, you know, it's not going to cost me my time in a sense. It's just something extra on the webpage. And hopefully that little bit of revenue will help out, also pay some of the monthly bills, which, by the way, I remind you, on my webpage also you can join my Patreon channel. And these are just ways of supporting me, a little bit of money every month, and you add it all together. And every month I have quite a few thousands of dollars worth of, you know, for my airtime for this show, for the internet, for, you know, there's all of these expenses. I'm sorry, there are. And so that helps pay for all of that. You know, just a little bit here and there, it adds up. So anyway, that's kind of exciting because it's another visible way of demonstrating support for my work. And it gives you a product. I don't take donations. I don't have sponsors or just give me money. And so anyway, this is a way of people supporting me. And then you get something of quality. And it also is a way for you to make a statement when your friends see it at your camp and around the campfire or something like that. Nice for fall, a hoodie or something like that. Or buy these for Christmas presents and give them out to your friends or relatives, etc. Okay, enough of that. But anyway, look for that also on my webpage. And the combination of my two sales pages traditionally have been separate. One is for the books, CDs, and all of that, and then the education package. All of that being combined with a new checkout system, like a regular shopping cart, much more streamlined, etc. Okay. Let's see. And also, I'm looking into this, and that is to be to take cryptocurrency. So you may see that come up to my water filter page, the JMCC water filters page, and then also my jmccanniescience.com. homepage, etc. So anyway, that might be coming. So if you're a person with crypto, you may have the ability, say, to buy these items with crypto in the very near future. So keep an eye out for that. Okay, so let me see. Okay, yeah. So the thing that I've been talking about getting to, finally, I'm going to get to on this show, and that is now, a few weeks ago, I mentioned a woman named Yvonne Whiteman, who's been writing some amazingly great material regarding the Colburn. And there are many, many other books around that are all coming to the same conclusion. And, of course, it's a conclusion that I have been talking about for a long time. Physical pole shifts, massive catastrophic events in the history of man, the fact that coal and especially oil are the real sources for them are somewhat unknown. And then also more and more people talking about Atlantis. And when I wrote my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, I had a friend that made a comment. He said, I've created more employment with that book than any other book in history. It was kind of a joke. But in that book, I introduced the idea of secret societies, etc. And this is around 2002, 2003 timeframe when that book was released to the public. My first book was Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, and that was like a big, it hit the presses and it went crazy. It would have been a New York Times bestseller list if it were sold through the normal channels, but I don't do that. It was all sold through my own channels, etc. And then the next book that came out was the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. And then, so when I announced that I was going to have a third book coming out, everybody thought it was going to be another Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book. something like that. And so when I was on Coast to Coast AM, George Norrie was the host. When he read the title, and of course, I pre-sold the book, which I have done with all of my books. I sold it before it was announced on the air. So anyway, the title was a secret. Nobody knew the contents. And it sold pretty good. And I'm one of the maybe the few people on the planet that can pre-sell a book without anybody knowing the title or the content or any even a hint about what it's about. But when Norrie announced the title on the radio, the web page went crazy. And I sold $42,000 of books that night. And it shut down my processor. It was my my gateway processing for my credit card. At the time, I only had a $5,000 limit. And all of a sudden, I get $42,000 worth of orders. A good problem to have. But my gateway processor shut it down and said, something's going on here. There's a problem. You know, you have not sold this kind of volume. And all of a sudden, one night, bam, this amazing. So anyway, they made me ship all the books, print them, ship them and everything, because I only had one printing available, which was 1,000 books, just if you want to know that, a single printing. And I went through many, many printings in that single night. So I had to print the books, ship them out, and then prove that the people got the books. And then they gave me the money. But that was back in the good old days. Now when you put a book out to publish, things are not that, they don't move quite like that. But that was a book that just really sparked the imagination of the public, and that's what happened. Because I think the public was just hungry for something like that. All of the Planet X, the Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens, all that stuff was going on at the time. So Planet X was the big topic. We had just gotten through the millennium bug thing. Remember, the computers were all going to go down because of crossing over the millennium, and the computers were going to go to zero, and the operating system was going to crash, and all computing would go, and the world economy was going to crash, which nothing happened, of course, because computers' registers go to roll over to zero all the time. That's a common thing, and computers don't crash, etc. So anyway, that was going on. So all of a sudden, I come out with a book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. So it has Atlantis, it has Tesla, it links them together through ancient history, etc. Then the Colburn was introduced to the Western society in that, and it was like something that just captured the public attention. And then the connection linking the past, the ancient past, with the future, and Tesla and Tesla technology, where I released the information about how Tesla towers actually worked, because that was one of the discoveries I had in there, a diagram, which was some of my research that actually was released into internal military sources, etc., in the early 1980s, with my first version of the electromagnetic propulsion system. And that was an IEEE paper. I actually reproduce it in that book with the specific impulse graphs, etc. And so that book was just, you know, it was short. And then to top it off, I talked about secret societies. And I remember on that show, George asked me, he said, Jim, what's a secret society? And so I said, well, these are societies that have existed throughout history, you know, the basic story. And believe me, that was everybody within like a month was talking about secret societies. That opened up more doors than anything for people to jump on these topics. And of course, there were people who studied these things in depth, but it never hit the public eye. And that's what was different about the Atlantis to Tesla book, is all of these things that I just mentioned came out at the very same time and in the same book. And the book is not long. The book is not long. I mean, you could read it and certainly under a couple hours and digest it. And it also capitalized on the fame that I had gained from the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. And remember, these are books that came out, well, because in inner circles, everybody knew who I was. back in the Cornell days, everybody knew who I was. And after that, I was going around to the like national laboratories and talking in internal military meetings regarding electromagnetic propulsion systems, something that nobody even had a clue about at that time. But this was the first book that really caught the public's imagination. It was kind of like all in that one book. It was a bombshell revelation type of book in the early 2000s. And then after that, my next big work was the weather book, which I call the weather book, and the Principia Meteorologiae, the physics of sun, earth, weather, where I talk about the electromagnetic conditions in the solar system and the weather, etc. But anyway, in those initial books and in the pamphlet that followed Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, the pamphlet is called Surviving Planet X Passage. I talk about pole shift and the physics of a pole shift. There's a very nice drawing in there illustrating how the upper crust and mantle of the Earth slide over the inner portion because of the viscous layer that's molten. And then inside you have this extremely compact, very hard inner core of the Earth. But when the outer layer of the Earth shifts over the inner core and the rotation, it discusses the physical pole shift and how it actually works. So anyway, I'm not going to repeat all of that here, but all of this was very important. But that book, Surviving Planet X Passage, and the discussion of how the pole shift works because of a large passing object that sends a gravitational wave into the upper layer of the Earth, causes it to shift, slide over the inner core, and that inner core keeps turning in the same direction. And the analogy that I used was like a egg. If you want to tell if an egg is hard-boiled or soft-boiled, what you do is you put it on a table and you spin it. Okay, so if the egg is hard-boiled, the egg keeps spinning at the same rate you started it at because it's all one solid piece. If the egg is soft-boiled or less than soft-boiled or raw, and you spin it, and this is a test because a lot of times people they're making hard-boiled eggs, or they're making soft-boiled eggs, and they want to know if the eggs, in fact, did they boil them too long, and they wanted to know if they're hard-boiled or soft-boiled. Take one of the eggs, put it on a counter, spin it. If it spins and continues spinning, then it's hard-boiled because the inside is solidified. If it's soft-boiled, then the outer shell, when you spin it, the outer shell spins, but the inside part does not because there's a viscous layer in there. And so the inside part doesn't spin, and so what happens? The outside part very quickly stops spinning because the inside part is not spinning. There's a viscous layer, and you just try it sometime. Take a raw egg and a hard-boiled egg, and you'll see that the soft-boiled egg or the raw egg will stop spinning almost immediately, whereas the hard-boiled egg will continue spinning. And the Earth is the same way. So when you have a gravitational wave come in, it affects the outer shell of the Earth, and it creates a wave, literally a wave, and that's where there's mountain building, etc. That's where the mountain building comes from. And then the inner part continues to spin like the soft-boiled or raw egg, and so then the outer shell picks up and continues spinning in that direction. Okay, so anyway, I described this in that little pamphlet. But now here's the point. Many people today are coming to the realization from other points of view that Earth experienced a physical pole shift and that the old North Pole was in a different place. And of course, I talk about this. It was in the mid-1990s. Of course, when I was a young person, I lived in Mexico. I visited the Mayan and the Aztec ruins and that type of thing, and I did a lot of work. But then I returned to Mexico in the mid-1990s, and with surveying equipment. And I went to Chichen Itza and Tulum and Uxmal, places I had visited when I was young, living in Mexico. I lived in Mexico City, and I was teaching the kids of rich people there. That's what I was doing. It was my first job out of college. I did not want to go directly to grad school. It was just like I needed something else in my life. So I went to Mexico, one of the best decisions of my life, alongside not going to the military naval academy. When I was a sophomore in college. That's right. I applied for the Air Force Academy. I wanted to fly jet planes. And that first year, I was not accepted. Al Cui was the senator from Minnesota, and every senator has two appointments. They can appoint some kids, and a lot of times they're associated with kids of political appointees or political supporters, and their kids get to go. Well, some guy was well-connected when I was a senior in high school that year to go to the Air Force Academy. And so I didn't get picked, but they said, wait till next year and we will pick you, because I had all the grades, I had all the tests, I had everything that was required. And so anyway, the next year I got an appointment to the Naval Academy, and I said, hey, Al, I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. He says, don't worry about it, just go the first year there, and then you can transfer to any of the other military schools from there the next year. So just go 1 year, and then you can transfer as you wish. I thought, okay, that sounds like a good deal. So I was all set up to go to the Naval Academy for my sophomore year. So I'm in my freshman year in college. I'm studying physics, mathematics. I'm all my testing done, my eyesight, physical tests, everything. And this guy takes me aside, the upperclassman at the school where I went, the private college where I was going to school. And he said, you know, what are you doing? I heard you're going to go to the Naval Academy. And I said, yeah, I'm going to leave tomorrow. And he goes, well, do you know there's a thing called the Vietnam War going on? And he said, what do you want to do that for? I said, well, I want to fly the jet planes. I want to be a high-performance jet fighter pilot. That sounds like a good time. He goes, well, let me tell you something. You're probably going to end up in a bamboo cage somewhere bombing other people. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? I didn't know anything about this. And so anyway, I probably, you know, I'm not that stupid. I knew about it, et cetera. But it didn't occur to me the ramifications of dropping napalm on people, and that would be my job, you know, not just flying high-performance jet planes. So I thought about it, and I thought, wow, this doesn't sound like a very good idea. So I called up Al Cui's office that next morning, and the secretary answers, and she goes, yes, James, what can I do for you? I said, well, I'm not going to go to the Naval Academy. She goes, what? What do you mean? You have your all set. You're supposed to leave. You're supposed to be there tomorrow. And what's this? Nobody turns down an appointment to the Naval Academy. No, these are congressional appointments. You cannot get anything better than this. What are you talking about? And I said, well, I'm not going to go. And she said, well, I don't know what to tell you. And I said, well, I'm just telling you, I'm not going. Sayonara. And anyway, I went on to get a conscientious objector status with the draft, which is a legal objection to going to war, etc. Still have my CO draft status card on file. But at any rate, I digress a little bit here. The reason I started talking about this was because after I got out of college, I had three fellowships to go to universities to continue my study of physics. And I said, you know, I'm not ready. I want to do something else. I want to do something. And something just told me, and this was the little voice that kind of has led me through my life, going to places, going, do this, go over here, where, you know, by following that route, I ended up in Cornell University as on the faculty, something that would not have happened if I had not followed this particular path. But anyway, so I go to Mexico, and I'm traveling around Mexico looking at the ruins and all of this. And so then many years later, after I got my master's degree in physics, I went to Tulane University, I went back to school, etc. And Tulane University, I got my master's degree in nuclear solid state physics. And then I continued on. I diverged a little bit here. But I did was in around the mid-1990s, I took some surveying equipment. I went back down to places I had been when I lived in Mexico and after college. So that's what the point of talking about that, where I was living in Mexico City. I was teaching the kids of the rich people and traveling throughout Mexico, just following my nose. And so anyway, when I went back there with surveying equipment, I went to the same locations where I was as a young person. And I surveyed Chichen Itza, I surveyed Tulum, Uxmal, and other locations. And then what I realized is, hey, you know, these places are not on a north, east, west, south quadrant. There's something strange here. And so anyway, they had been rebuilt. I realized they had been rebuilt on the standard directions of an old North Pole. And then when I started mapping these on the map, I came out to the conclusion that the old North Pole, according to the survey of these cities, was somewhere up in Hudson Bay. And my first estimate was that it was in Ontario, north of the state of Michigan, and since have revised that. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is because this is back before anybody had a clue about, you know, this type of issue. And so recently, there's been a lot of work, people recognizing other aspects of the world, other data points, so to speak, that indicate that Earth, in fact, had a pole shift. And these are like within the last 10,000 years. This is not millions of years ago or billions of years ago, like Carl Sagan would say, billions. No, we're talking within the last 10,000 years. And there had been a number of these shifts, pole shifts. And so anyway, there's a guy named Mark Gaffney. I've talked about him on my show previously. And he wrote a book, and I worked a lot with him when he was writing this. And in fact, he was a student, kind of a student of my work, amongst other things. He's written quite a few other books, etc. And but anyway, he wrote this book, and let me say the title of the Gaffney book is called Deep History and the Ages of Man. But what he's doing is he's looking at geological evidence and also plant life evidence, dealing with mollusks in the ocean and reef animals and things like this, showing how they switched locations in various places around the Earth, indicating that there, in fact, was a pole shift. And the reason that's important is because these little critters in the ocean are very, very sensitive to temperature. And so they had to migrate to new areas to maintain that same temperature. And so these are indicators. And then there's another guy that I was introduced to by Mark. His name is Mark Carlado. And he wrote a book also dealing with, it's called Before Atlantis. And once again, coming to the same conclusion that the old North Pole was up in the region of kind of the northwest region of Hudson Bay, what we call Hudson Bay, the big bay in northern Canada. And so these various different viewpoints coming together, converging on this same thing. And then more and more, there's other people who've written books recently also who are coming to this same conclusion. So the bottom line is that man, here's the point, the history of man has, in recent history, we're talking within the last 10,000 years, man was a vibrant species, you know, and the various different, you might say, classifications of man, the tall black man from Africa, the little Mayan natives in southwestern or southeastern Mexico and into Honduras, etc. And this is thousands of years ago. These are the ancient Maya, not the modern Maya, but the ancient Maya, the Olmecs, for example, of which there are traces of them in the jungles, etc. And the interesting thing about all of these races is that they passed down to their their descendants this information that there were major catastrophes. And of course, this is where the ancient texts come from that made up the Library of Joseph of Arimathea that eventually became the material that is contained now in the Colburn. And so anyway, everything is pointing to this, which also tells us that man, the history of man that is being taught in Western civilization, the hallmark of Western knowledge, is just couldn't even possibly be true. And so you look at the Incas, they talk about predecessors that came before them of which they knew nothing, that built the Nazca Lines, for example. A long time ago, I can't remember how many years ago, I had a woman on my radio show, and you should go to her YouTube channel. It's still there. It's all. I don't think she's making any new videos that I'm aware of anyway. But her name is Sylvia Ivanova, and I interviewed her on my radio program. It was one of the more interesting interviews I did, but it was primarily to discuss this issue of the history of man. And what she did is she went out and dug up all of this wonderful material about archaeological sites, etc., around the world that just don't fit in with the modern version of the history of man. And so, once again, Sylvia, I think it's Ivanova, Ivanova, she has a foreign accent, really just amazing discoveries that she's passing down to us. And then there's the Brian Forrester, who is working, has a lot of information on his YouTube channel, etc. So these are people who are all coming to this same conclusion, that there were some major catastrophes in the history of man. And these are things that couldn't happen. This is not like a little local earthquake. This is something that, I remember one of Brian Forrester's movies, he's over in the Mideast, and this is where the big electrical discharges from Venus came through, and we know this from the history of Moses, where they had a discharge that connected up into the clouds. It was the pillar of fire, remember, from the story of Moses, that extended up, and he explains it like this electrical hurricane, not hurricane, but tornado, that is literally attached to the ground, and that would have been very typical of a electrical discharge from a passing comet that connected to Earth and just stayed there for a number of probably 4 to 6 hours. And then as the comet slowly moved, it reconnected someplace else. In the desert there, I think I have a picture of this in my Picture of the Day subpage. It's called the Eye of the Sahara, but you can look it up online, Eye of the Sahara. That's E-Y-E-I, like your eyes in your head, Eye of the Sahara. And it's a place where there was a massive electrical discharge. And just incredible. You can see the rings, etc., and the glass, etc., that was formed as this electrical discharge was targeting this very spot. So one could imagine this comet marching with the electrical discharge, marching across the open fields as the passage went on. And this took place in all within a day's time. And so if you look at all the symbolism, for example, in Moses, they talk about the pillar of light in the sky, which followed them for the 40 years and lit their way at night. So they didn't have any light, but this thing was so bright in the sky, and it was in the daytime sky visible also. So it was like the moon, depending on where the Earth was in its orbit, etc. This thing was so bright in the solar system, and this was the comet Venus before it became a planet, before the tail drag dragged it into its current orbit as what we now call the planet Venus. This is one event. What's very clear from the Colburn and from people's work like Mark Gaffney, Carlotto, and even Velikovsky, towards the end of his life, started talking a little bit about other events. And one thing that I said very early on when I started to put the the scientific side of this altogether. And of course, where does my scientific work come in? It explains the comets. It explains how they work. It explains when you open up the Colburn. Somebody asked me the other day, they said, when you first got your hands on the Colburn and you started reading it, I was one of the first, the first three copies of the Colburn that were brought into the USA. I got one of the copies. It was given to me and brought to me, and the whole idea was for me to interpret what it meant. And so I open it up and I start reading, and it's, oh my goodness, they're talking about the rebirth of man, and these are the comets that are doing war up in the sky. These are multiple comets. And so it was something that confirmed in my mind that when these big comets were in the sky, there was more than one. And Velikovsky's study, of course, is dealing with just one comet, the comet Venus, that became the planet Venus. At any rate, my own, just the things that indicated to me that there were multiple big comets in the sky at one time. And by the way, they don't all come near Earth when this is going on. But one of them did, and that's where the Colburn is very accurate. It talks about the tidal waves. If you look at the Popol Vuh, and this is what's great, is we can start to now put some of these other old texts together. So the Popol Vuh is totally unrelated to the books that came out of Latin, which came through Rome, the Library of Joseph of Arimathea, that eventually went up to the Abbey at Glastonbury, which eventually became, pieces of that became the Colburn, which we have a view today. And we see the same exact descriptions come out of the Popol Vuh of the Mayans, which was totally, we know from history that the Mayans were totally disjointed from Europe, and any of the movements, the immigration, movements of people in Europe coming out of Egypt with Moses, the Israelites, etc., and moving up into Northern Europe, eventually up into Scandinavia, what we call Scandinavia, and eventually into the English and Ireland Isles, etc. And then my ancestors were the Vikings, which moved into Ireland. So there was another mass migration around 800 AD. But none of that, not any of that, none of that was related to the Mayans, which was an ocean away, and which was not even the beginning of the discovery of them. Didn't even begin until the 1600s. And then it was into the 1800s when the Mayas were actually rediscovered, etc., Catherwood, Stevens and Catherwood, etc. And so it was totally disjoint. And here we go, we get the Popol Vuh of the Maya, and it describes the exact same events with the tsunamis, the earthquakes, the Quetzalcoatl taking the ocean on its back and moving it across the land and destroying, etc. And you get that same, exact same story out of the Colburn. You get it out of the when Solon, the great uncle of Aristotle, went off to Egypt to ask what had happened. That's the story that came back, the story about Atlantis. And of course, Atlantis really didn't go under during one of the catastrophes, just like this continent, the Mu continent, or other people call it different things. There may have been more than one that slid into the Pacific Ocean. And these were slewing events. Like right now, we're looking at the Canary Islands, where there's a potential slewing event ready to occur there, where a big chunk of land mass just slides down off into the ocean. And so, and by the way, you see this on Mars. You see Olympus Mons, the biggest volcano in the solar system is on Mars. It's called Olympus Mons. You can see the slewing events there, and that only happens when you have a large ocean present, because once that land gets into the ocean and slides, it slides way out like a big toboggan, basically. And a lot of this, by the way, geology of this type was done on planet Earth. There's a lot of work by scientists off the islands of Hawaii, where big chunks of land would slew down into the ocean. Just huge amounts of land just slide off like a big toboggan. and out there in the ocean. And the end result, of course, is a giant tsunami. But Atlantis did not go under during something like the Venus event. It was a natural occurring slewing event where it just dropped into the ocean one day. And that's the story of Atlantis and of Mu also. Lemuria, some people call it. There are other names for that. And there indicates, this history indicates that there was more than one massive island continent in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, which went under at a certain point in time with a high population being lost at that time. So the history of man, let me just put it this way. What they're teaching in schools today, that's another good reason just to close down the schools. Not including all of the other baloney that they teach in schools, etc. But at any rate, very interesting. And so I wanted to talk about this. And then I was going to read all the different titles of the books that are out now discussing this same topic. But the reason I'm not going to is because I've not read these books myself to see what kind of twists there might be. And a lot of authors still don't understand what comets are. There's authors that talk about comets, but don't understand that they're not dirty snowballs. And so you have this mix of kind of bad information by people that maybe make some kind of observation. And then there's a lot of people who simply repeat what's already been known. So since I've not read any of these other books, then I'm not going to give the names on the air as somehow promoting them. But I did give the names of like Yvonne Whiteman's books before the Unlock the Mysteries of the Colbrun, part one, Sacred and Scandalous Egypt, and the other part, Genetic and Global Catastrophes, Mark Gaffney's book, Deep History and the Ages of Man. And you'll see my influence in that book quite a bit, but authored by Mark Gaffney. And of course, he was the person that put a lot of this information together regarding the mollusks and the other geological evidence of a pole shift and the old North Pole being different. And then, of course, I mentioned Mark Carlotto. And Mark is interesting because this is not his field. I believe he's a chemist. So he has a completely different career as a university-level professor chemist. I believe it. If I'm wrong there, forgive me. But at any rate, the point is that he has picked up on this idea of the pole shift and gathered a lot of evidence and indicating, and all of these come together in the old North Pole being in the what is now Hudson Bay. And also Hapgood, a guy named, is it Robert Hapgood? I forget his first name, who came a lot earlier, who was talking about this same type of thing. And so anyway, the history of man is just very different than what you've been taught. And it does include, and for example, the whole issue of Noah. The Noah's flood was a worldwide flood. And there's a guy in Ohio, I don't know much about all of the belief systems that go around this, but who has built an ark. And I think it's a public, like a tourist type of thing where you can go see it. And they talk about how did they feed the animals, where did the food come from, all the different things that had to happen for Noah's Ark. In fact, I did a show one time dealing with the construction of Noah's Ark, just given the concept of boat building, and how would you manage a ship that size on a really rough ocean, and it was with sea anchors, that you would have sea anchors, and that would keep you aligned with the wind and the waves and allow the boat to operate on the ocean full of all of this cargo of animals and birds and everything, all the animals in the earth. And so it's a very real story, so to speak. At any rate, a couple of quick topics before the end of the show. This year's Nobel Prizes, and this year's Nobel Prize in Physics and last year's both were for climate change. Talk about politically motivated. Usually they choose something real different for each successive year. But for 2 years in a row, these are people that have just done statistical studies, on how to take systems that are random and find some kind of direction in them, something that actually violates the three laws of thermodynamics. By the way, and you can find statistical aberrations such as rogue waves as a good example. What is the average height of a wave on the ocean? Well, it's so much. And you can, but there are rogue waves that defy the statistical average. And so there's nothing new about this, but to say, oh, this proves climate change, good grief, and giving Nobel Prizes, purely politically motivated. But the EPA came out with their definition of 70 parts per trillion. I've talked about this before. And now there's an actual standard. My water filters actually, through private testing, can meet these standards. So the whole house water filter, the sink filters, the gravity filter, replacement filter elements that I have in my webpage are there and still on sale. You can use the coupon code JMCC for an extra 10% off at checkout. It's in the when you're at the at your shopping cart, there's a little box put in the coupon code JMCC, gets you another 10% off. Very interesting. I already mentioned that very soon I'll be taking cryptocurrency and also have T-shirts on the JMCC, or on, I'm sorry, on the JMCanniescience.com webpage for sale. And that's as a promotion to go along with my education package and my books, etc., because I'm stressing education. That's where I'm putting a lot of focus lately to get kids up to speed. And then there'll be programs, special programs for students, etc. Some of them dealing with space, some of them dealing with other experimental programs where they can do physics experiments, etc. So very important to really put a new twist on science and get rid of the old science. And that's what something I'm saying is that the accredited science that's being forced on the public now to get that accreditation is really bogus. And it's holding the torch to people's feet because they want to have accredited science. So I'm selling mine as a science supplement to show them how bogus this science program is. I don't care if you're in kindergarten, preschool, grade school, high school, university, graduate school. The science they're teaching is really a travesty. So at any rate, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's the J. McCanny Science webpage. And then the other webpage, the JMCC Water Filters page, that's where all the water filter stuff is now. And I'm about out of time here. Just be safe, be happy, don't worry, don't continue to listen to all of the fear-mongering. Turn off the TV is one of the best ways to do that. And I will see you next week, everybody. James McCanny, this is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.